This is podcast number 25 for the Well-Educated Mother's Heart. I'm Marlene Peterson, and today I'll be sharing lessons from William Bradford and the Pilgrims. While I've been sad to watch what's happened to Christopher Columbus over the last few years, I thought to myself, at least no one can find faults with the Pilgrims. Not so fast. Coming to a town near you, the new twisted narrative, Pilgrims, America's first terrorist group. We have to know our history, and in this case, we have a critical piece of evidence, William Bradford's journal, that recorded an eyewitness look at the events and the thought processes behind them. What we now call of Plymouth Plantation is a national treasure that actually went missing for about 100 years. It had been left in the tower of the Old South Meeting House in Boston, which was occupied by British soldiers, and after the war was over, the journal had vanished. Some feared it had been destroyed when they ransacked the place. Others feared it had been carried off and carelessly thrown away. Decades later, a man picked up a book in England that contained a history of the Protestant Episcopal Church and noticed that parts of Bradford's journal had been quoted. He reasoned, the only way that could have happened is if the journal had survived. A little detective work brought him to the Bishop of London's library at Fulham Palace. No one knows how it had gotten there, and had it not been for that random connection, it may still be there, forgotten by the world at large. It would be another 40 complicated years before it was finally brought home to America. Its arrival in 1897 was an occasion of great celebration. It was seen as one of the most precious manuscripts on earth. Senator Hoare said, if there were in existence in England a history of King Alfred's reign for 30 years, written by his own hand, it could not be more precious in the eyes of Englishmen than this manuscript is to us. Another speaker on the occasion said, wherever it shall go, it will be an object of reverent care. I do not think many Americans will gaze upon it without a little trembling at the lips and a little gathering of mist in the eye as they think of the story of suffering, of sorrow, of peril, of exile, of death, and of lofty triumph which the book tells. There is nothing like it in human annals since the story of Bethlehem. Well, 15 years ago when I heard about it, I was living in Salt Lake City. There was only one paperback version of this treasured manuscript in all the Salt Lake City, Salt Lake County, and Utah County library systems. I checked it out and read it cover to cover and was moved beyond tears at what I learned. Later, when I started compiling the Forgotten Classics Library, I had intended to include a popular little book of the Pilgrims by Margaret Pumphrey. But after reading the journal, I thought how not true to the facts the little book is. Although it is appealing to little children and therefore serves a purpose of awakening desire. So I looked for something else and came across a book written for children by one of the leading authorities on the Pilgrims' history of the day, Roland Usher. In the preface, he noted that many legends had sprung up in the absence of Bradford's journal. But as it had recently surfaced and had been brought back to America, he used only those accounts that could be verified by the journal. That's the first book you'll find in Stories of the Pilgrim, as well as the audio version that I'll post in the podcast notes. And you'll also find several excerpts from Bradford's journal in the back section of the Forgotten Classics book. In the late 1800s, Woodrow Wilson was having a conversation with other thinkers of the day who were concerned with what was happening to our country. We were losing our national spirit, our morals were declining, and Wilson remarked, "Our liberties are safe until the memories and experiences of the past are blotted out and the Mayflower with its band of pilgrims forgotten, until our public school system has fallen into decay and the nation into ignorance." Those are sobering words for all liberty-loving people. These men concluded that refreshing our stories would wake the people up and renew their spirits. We need that today more than ever. William Bradford knew that too, for he expressed in his journal, "We have noted these things, that you may see the worth of these things, and not negligently lose what your fathers have obtained with so much hardship." The story of the Pilgrims is one even young children can relate to because it's a story of families. Unlike the Jamestown settlement 13 years earlier that was settled by dandies in their silks and their manservants out on their particular, dreaming of castles in the air, over 80% of them died the first year because even with starvation staring them in the face, the thought of getting their hands dirty was repulsive to them. No, the story of the Pilgrims is the story of young families, just like many of you, mothers and fathers in their 20s and their 30s. Of the 100 or two so passengers on the Mayflower, 39 of them were children. William Bradford was only 30 years old. Those of you with a 4 or 5 or 6-year-old, take him, hold him, and look him in the eyes, and imagine the feelings of William and Dorothy as they left their little 5-year-old son in the care of friends in Holland, not knowing if they would ever see him again. Dorothy didn't. While the Mayflower was anchored in the harbor and William was on shore trying to find a suitable place to settle, Dorothy somehow fell overboard and was drowned. William remembered and recorded the scene of their departure from Holland. That night was spent with little sleep by the most, but with friendly entertainment and other real expressions of true Christian love. The next day, the wind being fair, they went aboard and their friends with them, where truly doleful was the sight of that sad and mournful parting, to see what sighs and sobs and prayers did sound amongst them, what tears did gush from every eye, and pithy speeches pierced every heart. That sundry of the Dutch strangers that stood on the quay as spectators could not refrain from tears. Their reverend pastor falling down on his knees, and they all with him, and with watery cheeks, commended them with most fervent prayers to the Lord and his blessing. And then with mutual embraces and many tears, they took their leaves one of another, which proved to be the last leave to many of them. It was by many thought an adventure almost desperate, a case intolerable, and a misery worse than death. So what drove them to take such a drastic step? Bradford noted they were hunted and persecuted on every side. Some were taken and clapped up in prison. Others had their houses beset and watched day and night. And the most were fain to flee and leave their houses and habitations and the means of their livelihood. And what was their crime? They had read the precious words of the Bible for themselves and longed to raise their children according to the simple and humble teachings of Jesus Christ. For the simple act of reading the Bible, children were made to witness against their parents and watch their parents be burned at stakes with their Bibles around their necks. Believers were thrown in prisons and even beheaded for going against their government. Thank goodness we're more civilized and sensible, right? But do we not see homeschoolers, for example, living in fear of Child Protective Services coming to their doors and taking their children away for not complying with government regulations, or for being shunned by neighbors and friends for wanting to give their children a different kind of education? Can you not relate to the feelings of these pilgrims as they long for a place to be free and to raise their families without interference? How much would you sacrifice for the right to live according to the dictates of your own conscience? Or maybe the right question appears to be, in the near future, how much will you sacrifice for the right to live according to the dictates of your own conscience? Will it be worth your home, your job, your standing in the community, your reputation? William reminds us, all great and honorable actions are accompanied with great difficulties and must be overcome with answerable courages. And then he tells us again why he gave us the record that he did, as he wrote, I have been larger in these things, that their children may see with what difficulties their fathers wrestled in going through these things in their first beginnings, and how God brought them along, notwithstanding all their weaknesses and infirmities, as also that some may be made hereof in all after times by others in such like weighty employments. He wrote to you and to me. And his answer as to how they got through it was always the same. These things did not dismay them. though they did sometimes trouble them, for their desires were set on the ways of God. They rested on His providence and knew whom they had believed. They looked heavenward and quieted their fears. What could now sustain them but the Spirit of God and His grace? And while they did not escape sorrow and hardship, heaven did provide. The Mayflower was originally meant to take them to Virginia, where they had been granted a charter. A fierce storm in the middle of the ocean crossing carried them off course, and they found themselves in the Massachusetts Bay instead. Several attempts were made to go to Virginia, but the way was too dangerous, and they had to settle on a new destination. Was it coincidence that, in this accidental destination, there lived a native, Squanto, who had been kidnapped and carried to England, where he lived and learned the language and had only recently returned to his home? His people had tragically been wiped out by an illness. He was alone, but he became friends and lived with the pilgrims, teaching them how to survive in the new world, which was a good thing because none of the seeds they had brought from England would grow. Bradford described him as a special instrument sent of God for their good beyond their expectation. After fighting off starvation for several seasons, the pilgrims planted and hoped for a good harvest. But William recorded, "By a great drought which continued from the third week of May till about the middle of July, without any rain, and with great heat for the most part, insomuch as the corn began to wither away, though it was set with fish. Yet at length it began to languish sore, and some of the drier grounds were perched like withered hay, part whereof was never recovered. Upon which they set apart a solemn day of humiliation, to seek the Lord by humble and fervent prayer in this great distress. And He was pleased to give them a gracious and speedy answer, both to their own and the Indians' admiration that lived amongst them. For all the morning and greatest part of the day, it was clear weather and very hot, and not a cloud or any sign of rain to be seen. Yet toward evening it began to overcast, and shortly after to rain such sweet and gentle showers as gave them cause of rejoicing and blessing God. It came without either wind or thunder or any violence, and by degrees in that abundance as that the earth was thoroughly wet and soaked in therewith, which did so apparently revive and quicken the decayed corn and other fruits, as was wonderful to see, and made the Indians astonished to behold. And afterwards the Lord sent them such seasonable showers, with interchange of fair warm weather, as, through His blessing, caused a fruitful and liberal harvest, to their no small comfort and rejoicing, for which mercy, in time convenient, they also set apart a day of thanksgiving. Famine hath not been amongst them since to this day." It seems that William Bradford saw the naysayers of our day and addressed some of the very falsehoods I am seeing spread around. One of those stories is that, for all their profession of Christian ideals, they weren't so pure. He wrote, "It may be demanded how came it to pass that so many wicked persons and profane people should so quickly come over into this land and mix themselves amongst them. Seeing it was religious men that began the work and then came for religion's sake. I confess this may be marveled at least in time to come, when the reasons thereof should not be known, and the more because here were so many hardships and wants met withal. I will therefore endeavor to give some answer hereunto." And then he lists reasons. 1. According to that in the gospel, it is ever to be remembered that where the Lord begins to sow good seed, there the envious man will endeavor to sow tares. 2. Men being to come over into a wilderness, wherein much labor and service was to be done about building and planting, many untoward servants, sundry of them proved, that were thus brought over, both men and womankind, became families of themselves, which gave increase hereunto. 3. To make up their freight and advance their profit, cared not who the persons were, so they had money to pay them. And by this means the country became pestered with many unworthy persons who, being come over, crept into one place or another. So first we need to understand that not everyone on board the Mayflower came for religious freedom. Only about half of them did. The other half consisted of workers hired to help, such as Miles Standish, a veteran of the Dutch Wars, who came as a soldier for their protection. John Alden, who only planned on staying a short time. He was a cooper. His job was to make barrels. When Priscilla Mullins lost every member of her family, John fell in love with her and stayed. They married and had 11 children. But there were also loud, obnoxious, good-for-nothings like the Billingtons. The father had the distinction of being the first man to be hanged in America. His son nearly blew up the Mayflower playing in the gunpowder room. Keep in mind, those who financed the venture were interested in making money, not propagating freedom. The conditions of the agreement were harsh, but the Pilgrims had no other choice. They were nothing more than indentured servants to the financiers, and they didn't care who came over. The Billingtons were evidently just warm bodies, expected to produce some income for them. Who knows what they were fleeing from in England? But ample examples are given of true Christianity in action as practiced by the true Pilgrims, starting with their conduct as they attempted to flee from England to the safety of Holland. They had already been betrayed once. Another attempt was made, and due to precautionary measures, many of the husbands had boarded a ship when the authorities came to arrest and haul them back. In a panic, the captain hoisted anchor and sailed away to Holland, leaving the women and children behind, who happened to be carrying all the money and possessions. Bradford recorded, "Pitiful it was to see the heavy case of these poor women in this distress. What weeping and crying on every side, some for their husbands that were carried away in the ship, others not knowing what should become of them and their little ones. Others again melted in tears, seeing their poor little ones hanging about them, crying for fear and quaking with cold." They were arrested and paraded from town to town. No one knew what to do with them. But note this from Bradford, "Yet I may not omit the fruit that came hereby, for by these so public troubles in so many eminent places, their cause became famous and occasioned many to look into the same, and their godly carriage and Christian behavior was such as left a deep impression in the minds of many." Their godly carriage and Christian behavior, they let their light shine. Another example is during that awful first winter when half of them died. When it was all over, only 4 of the 14 women were still alive. But most of the children had survived. I've heard it suggested maybe the reason the children lived is because the mothers were doing what mothers do. Maybe they sacrificed their portion of the scanty measure of food for the sustenance of their children. Or maybe they lied their bodies over their children to keep them warm, but in the end freezing themselves. We'll never know for sure. And isn't that something to think about, that most of who we call our Pilgrim fathers were children? But this is the part I wanted to share as Bradford compared the way the Pilgrims treated each other in a spirit of Christian love and how the crew on board that had stayed through the winter treated each other. Bradford wrote, "So, as there died sometimes 2 or 3 a day, that of 100 and odd persons, scarce 50 remained. And of these, in the time of most distress, there were but 6 or 7 sound persons, who to their great commendation spared no pains, night nor day, but with abundance of toil and hazard of their own health, fetched them wood, made them fires, dressed them meat, made their beds, washed their loathsome clothes, clothed and unclothed them. In a word, did all the homely and necessary offices for them, which dainty and queasy stomachs cannot endure to hear named. And all this, willingly and cheerfully, without any grudging in the least, showing herein their true love unto their friends and brethren, a rare example and worthy to be remembered. On the ship, however, half of the men on the ship died. For they that before had been boon companions in drinking and jollity in the time of their health and welfare began now to desert one another in this calamity, saying they would not hazard their lives for them, would do little or nothing for them, but if they died, let them die. There had been a proud young man, one of the crew members, who had often cursed and scoffed at the passengers, Bradford continued. But when he grew weak, they had compassion on him and helped him. Then he confessed he did not deserve it at their hands. He had abused them in word and deed. Oh, saith he, you, I now see, show your love like Christians indeed one to another, but we let one another lie and die like dogs. Following that harsh winter, the captain of the Mayflower offered to carry anyone back to England who wanted to return. Isn't it incredible? Given all the hardship and misery and suffering, not one took up the offer. One more example of doing good to those who despitefully use you, of honoring our commitments and being honest in our dealings. After that first horrible winter, they laid up in store what they could to face another winter, which was barely sustainable as it was. A ship, the Fortune, sailed into the harbor. At first they were excited. Surely the ship brought badly needed supplies to them. Nope, it carried 35 more bodies. Sent over by the financiers. They brought with them no food, no bedding, nor pot, nor pan, nor coat, nor cloak, just more mouths to feed. Yet they were taken in and treated with care and kindness. But even more painful was the letter sent over from Thomas Weston, who had been their agent between them and the moneylenders. He was mad that they sent the Mayflower back with no products to sell. He wrote, "That you sent no lading in the ship is worthily distasted. I know your weakness was the cause of it, and I believe more weakness of judgment than weakness of hands. A quarter of the time you spent in discoursing, arguing, and consulting would have done much more, but that is past." And he signed the letter, "Your loving friend, Thomas Weston." In part, Radford's reply was, "You greatly blame us for keeping the ship so long in the country, and then to send her away empty. She lay 5 weeks at Cape Cod, whilst, with many a weary step, after a long journey, and the endurance of many a hard brunt, we sought out in the foul winter a place of habitation. Then we went in so tedious a time to make provisions to shelter us and our goods, about which labor many of our arms and legs can tell us to this day we were not negligent. But it pleased God to visit us then with death daily, and with so general a disease that the living were scarce able to bury the dead, and the well not in any measure sufficient to tend the sick. And now to be so greatly blamed for not freighting the ship doth indeed go near us and much discourage us. But you say you know we will pretend weakness. And do you think we had not cause? Yes, you tell us you believe it, but it was more weakness of judgment than of hands. Our weakness herein was great, we confess. Therefore we will bear this cheek patiently amongst the rest, till God send us wiser men. But they which told you we spent so much time in discoursing and consulting, their hearts can tell their tongues, they lie. They cared not, so that they might salve their own sores, how they wounded others. Indeed, it is our calamity beyond expectations, yoked with some ill-conditioned people who will never do good, but corrupt and abuse others." Unfair as the accusations were, and as destitute their conditions, they loaded up the Fortune with good clapboard and 2 hogshead of beaver and otter skins, and sent it back to England to begin to repay the debt. But the cargo never made it. French pirates seized the ship and took everything on board. That didn't keep Bradford from honoring the agreement. He and a couple of the other leaders took on the burden of the debt and, in time, completely discharged it. What a lesson in honoring our obligations, no matter how unfair. Another false impression is that of the Pilgrims being America's first terrorists, like I mentioned at the beginning. The fact is, they lived in friendship with the native tribes around them and had decades of peace. There were other tribes who meant to do them harm, and their friends warned them, and they had to deal with them with harsh measures. But their intention was to live in peace, which they did. But always there was the problem of others who were coming to this new world, and Bradford wrote, "I fear these people will hardly deal so well with the savages as they should. I pray you therefore signify to Squanto that they are a distinct body from us, and we have nothing to do with them, neither must we be blamed for their faults. Oh my goodness, the riffraff that came must have been so frustrating to deal with, yet time after time, Bradford and the Pilgrims treated them with kindness and compassion, even when betrayed and when harm was done to them. You'll have to read about all of those experiences yourself, including when Thomas Weston himself showed up begging in rags. I love the story of the Pilgrims. I keep discovering new insights every time I come back to their story. And I feel a little sad every time I come to this entry in Bradford's journal. By the time he wrote this, the Puritans had settled in Boston. They weren't poor, and with them came many opportunities for making money. It wasn't the suffering or the hardships that broke up their little Plymouth colony. In the end, it was prosperity. He wrote, "And thus was this poor church left, like an ancient mother grown old and forsaken of her children. Thus she that had made many rich became herself poor." On a piece of paper separate from his journal, he wrote, "O sacred bond, whilst inviolably preserved, how sweet and precious were the fruits that flowed from the same. But when this fidelity decayed, then their ruin approached. Oh, that these ancient members had not died or been dissipated if it had been the will of God, or else that this holy care and constant faithfulness that had still lived and remained with those that survived and were in times afterwards added unto them. But alas, that subtle serpent hath slyly wound in himself, under fair pretenses of necessity and the like, to untwist these sacred bonds and ties, and as it were, insensibly by degree to dissolve, or in great measure to weaken the same. I have been happy in my first times to see, and with much comfort to enjoy, the blessed fruits of this sweet communion, but it is now a part of my misery in old age, to find and feel the decay and want thereof in great measure, and with grief and sorrow of heart to lament and bewail the same, and for others' warning and admonition, and my own humiliation, do I here note the same." The end of his journal simply has at the top of the last two pages, Anno 1647, Anno 1648. I sense sadness there. Yet, as is the case with all of us, we cannot always see the ripple effect of our actions. They had undertaken the whole adventure with a great hope and an inward zeal of laying some good foundation, or at least to make some way thereunto, for the propagating and advancing the gospel of the kingdom of Christ in those remote parts of the world, yea, though they should be but even as stepping stones unto others for the performing of so great a work. Indeed, they were stepping stones. Thus, out of small beginnings, greater things have been produced by his hand that made all things of nothing, and gives being to all things that are. And as one small candle may light a thousand, so the light here kindled hath shone unto many, yea, in some sort to our whole nation. Let the glorious name of Jehovah have all the praise. Today, more than 35 million Americans can trace their direct ancestry lines to the handful of passengers on the Mayflower, including my husband, who is among William Bradford's descendants. If you'd like to find out if you are among them, I'm providing a link in the podcast notes. The struggle for freedom continues. May we not negligently lose that which was bought by so dear a price, by instilling the lessons of faith and trust and diligence in the hearts of our children, in part by never allowing the memory of the Mayflower and her Pilgrims from being blotted out. So now I'll close with a poem by Felicia Hermans. The breaking waves dashed high on a stern and rock-bound coast, and the woods against stormy sky their giant branches tossed, and the heavy night hung dark, the hills and water o'er, when a band of exiles moored their bark on the wild New England shore. Not as the conqueror comes, they, the true-hearted, came, not with the roll of the stirring drums and the trumpet that sings of fame, not as the flying come in silence and in fear, They shook the depths of the desert's gloom with their hymns of lofty cheer. Amidst the storm they sang, and the stars heard, and the sea, and the sounding aisles of the dim woods rang to the anthem of the free. The ocean eagle soared from his nest by the white waves' foam, and the rocking pines of the forest roared. This was their welcome home. There were men with hoary hair amidst the pilgrim band. Why had they come to wither there, away from their childhood's land? There was woman's fearless eye, lit by her deep love's truth. There was manhood's brow, serenely high in the fiery heart of youth. What sought they thus afar? Bright jewels of the mine? The wealth of seas? The spoils of war? They sought a faith's pure shrine. I call it holy ground, the soil where first they trod. They have left unstained what there they found, freedom to worship God. Bye-bye. See you next time.